ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
So how much coffee have you had today, Priya?
Today is a poor day for me to answer this question. I've had more than my norm because I didn't sleep well.
Oh, so you're juiced up.
Juiced up. It's still less than what a lot of patients tell me they drink. So I've had probably 3 shots of coffee today.
All right. Well, I'm up about 5.
Oh, wow. No yeah. Palpitations, anxiety? Would you sleep tonight?
No, I'm just sort of, I think it probably just brings me back to normal, really. This is a sign of addiction, isn't it?
It's doing nothing for me today.
Anyway, coming up on the Health Report, we are going to be talking about whether or not coffee's bad for your heart. And the results of the study might surprise you.
We're worth a listen today. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Jagera and Turrbal Land.
Also on the show, findings from a clinical trial may reshape how children with asthma are treated.
How far are we away from using blood tests to screen for cancer and monitor it? So instead of doing painful biopsies, can you just do a blood test? We'll find out more about that new technology.
In the news, though, there has been the results of the PFAS inquiry handed down with 47 recommendations for Australia when it comes to these what are known as forever chemicals.
Yes, polyfluoroalkyl substances. There's thousands of them in the environment. They take a long time to break down. There's been a panic about them. Some have actually been banned, and we've come to that later than others. PFOS and PFOA, we've banned them in Australia. But this is a Senate inquiry which has looked at this, and they've made 47 recommendations. We can't really go through them all here. A lot of it is actually about biomonitoring and monitoring in the environment. Some of it is about the availability of testing, and that will be controversial, A, expensive, and B, what are you going to do when you find out? Because you may have PFAS in your body which don't do you any harm. Not a nice idea, but don't do you any harm, and you'll create worry and concern in the community. So the 47 recommendations, they've taken it very seriously. The question is, what do you do from here? And it's already becoming political, with the chair of the committee calling on the Labor government to do something about it.
But they are recommending standardised guidelines for drinking water across all states and territories, and this watchdog, as you said, to actually give people more reliable information. But these are chemicals that are in non-stick cookware, firefighting foam.
That's right. And some of these products, it's relatively straightforward to remove these forever chemicals, sometimes not. Some of these forever chemicals look as though they're safe, but they haven't all been tested in animals, much less humans. You know, PFOA, PFOS could well increase the risk of kidney cancer, but the rest is just unknown. And while you might think that there was a sceptical tone in my voice a little while ago, I mean, I think that on the Health Report, we talk a lot about the precautionary principle, which is if stuff's out there, could be doing you harm, you're not quite sure, and it doesn't do you any harm to remove it, then remove it.
But it can be costly. I'm not sure. I love my non-stick cookware. This is the first time that I've thought about potentially replacing it. So if I have a new kitchen.
All the programs I've made on it all these years has had no impact. Now that a Senate inquiry is reported, now I'm going to believe
it. That's not what I'm saying. I can't possibly take every recommendation, Norman. I think that's the thing. People are so bombarded with information that you have to pick and choose what you take and what you can actually implement. And it's costly to change your cookware.
It's very costly. But let me tell you, when you do and you start cooking on cast iron, you'll wonder, why didn't you do it before? An omelette is the way to get a perfect omelette.
I'll keep you posted. But perhaps from one chemical to another, and this is another area I think people are bombarded in, is ultra-processed foods or UPFs. And I think people will have heard a lot about them this week because Lancet, which is the big medical journal, has released a 3-part series reviewing ultra-processed foods and the public health implications of them. and they've involved 43 global experts. And this is a huge discussion. There's lots of elements to this, I think.
And what they're trying to do here is eliminate what the global food industry has been doing, which is casting doubt on the risks of ultra-processed foods and creating confusion in people's minds.
So, and heavily marketing. Let's be honest here. We're talking about huge corporations. These are multi-billion dollar companies who have very cleverly and heavily marketed these products. They don't label always what is in them. And that's a part of this series. Experts are saying we don't necessarily know what complex ingredients are in the products, what's been put in there to extend the shelf life, how much it changes the nature of the food. But look, I'm of the view, and this is where we may differ.
Oh, what are you going to say?
Automatically disagree. I think everything has a place. I'm one of those, everything in moderation is okay. Some ultra-processed foods have a place. Bread, by definition, can be an ultra-processed food. I try and buy the one with seeds in it for the kids and I.
Margarine.
Yes, so some things do have a place, and there are some experts of this 43 who've said in discussion of this series that we shouldn't necessarily be lumping things like bread and flavoured yogurts in the same group as sugar drinks or reconstituted meals, that there needs to be some kind of way to divide the ultra-processed foods. But I guess the thing here is we're talking about not just sometimes having, you know, today I had a cookie. I needed the cookie, Norman. The cookie's fine.
It takes up 60% of your diet, which in some countries it does.
In Australia, the discussion has been that almost half of what Australians are currently eating is an ultra-processed food diet. And it's really cleverly marketed. It often looks like health food. It's these protein bars. We don't know how it changes all these emulsifiers and things that make it feel good in your mouth and make it tasty and sit on the shelf for a long time. How does it change how it interacts in the body? And it really replaces whole foods because you eat those, you're less likely to eat the orange or the banana or whatever else it is.
You might say, well, protein powders, bread, that sort of thing. So it's a wide range, as you say. So why are they bad for you? They're bad for you because you are consuming products that are not necessarily high in micronutrients. If they've got micronutrients in them, they're not embedded in foods where you're getting all the chemicals that go along with these micronutrients. You know, you can put all the micronutrients you like inside food, almost like a supplement, but you're not necessarily going to absorb them and you're not necessarily going to use them. You use them in food, often that's been cooked, and there's been a chemical reaction in the pot and you get these bioactive compounds. So we should be eating as much as possible food that we've prepared ourselves or that somebody else has prepared, but it looks like food, tastes like food, and not trust some factory process to put it in for you.
I don't think, though, the solution is, and often around this discussion, and I've already seen it this week, people start to go, just ban ultra-processed foods. And I don't think that's the solution because there are so many things that impact what we eat, food and diet, including socioeconomic, education, geographical factors. There are people living in food deserts. We know that the people who tend to consume more of these foods tend to be financially disadvantaged. And so just banning it just widens the gap in terms of food security and access. And so that can't be the solution. And what these experts are calling for is better labelling of food, more regulation of the industry. This industry spends $13.5 billion on advertising every year, which is four times more than the entire operating budget of the World Health Organization. That's just baffling.
Yeah. It's extraordinary.
They're very effective. So, look, this all ties in. Really what they're calling for, these experts, is consumers need to be upskilled. Packaging needs to be much clearer. There needs to be more regulation. But it all kind of ties in as well to the Health Star rating in Australia, doesn't it? Which we've talked about before.
Well, that's right. And you can get distortions of those ratings because some ultra-processed foods can score quite highly on them. There's an enormous amount of work to be done here.
And of course, the new dietary guidelines are coming out next year, which is going to try and tackle some of this, because earlier in the year, we covered the fact that you might be eating within the current dietary guidelines and eating what they say is too many ultra-processed foods.
And just given that, you know, one of our favourite topics is GLP-1 agonists, and so every Health Report listener now knows what we're talking about, the Ozempic-like drugs used for diabetes, now weight loss, and coming down the line are oral versions of these drugs, which look as if they're fairly effective. Eli Lilly has sponsored a paper in The Lancet of an oral version of these weight loss drugs called Orforglipron.
We don't know how to say it yet.
Orforglipron is the name of the drug. This is a placebo-controlled trial. So against placebo, it has weight loss. We've yet to find out how it performs in relation to other injectables.
And worth pointing out that this was studied in people who had a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes and who were also living with overweight and obesity. And not only did they seem to have a weight reduction in the intervention arm in the group who took the oral drug, also a lot of their other measures like cholesterol and sugars and things also improved. But again, watch this space.
And remember, most of these trials are sponsored by the drug companies and they're much more likely to present positive results. So keep listening to the Health Report for a slightly skeptical view of the world.
A measured view. We're not skeptics. Measured.
No. Well, I'm a skeptic. You may be measured. You keep me under control, Priya.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. I believe you spoke to another classmate of mine.
I did. You know, all these people who've become professors, illustrious.
And here I am sitting in the studio with Norman Swan.
And I said, Priya sends her regards. And he said, who? Just joking. He remembers you fondly. She was the annoying one in the front seat. No, she didn't say that.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm really lucky. I haven't had any of my classmates on the show, so that's the advantage.
Mine were all very clever. I was part of a clever cohort, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, it helps to have graduated in Scotland. They didn't really listen to Australian radio programs. Anyway, the reason that we got your ex-classmate on, Professor Christopher Wong, who's a cardiologist at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, is that they've done a randomised trial of coffee in people with atrial fibrillation. So this is your oral for your exam. Priya, tell us what atrial fibrillation is.
So I could act it out for you, but basically the top
chunks of the heart. You
couldn't
act out atrial fibrillation?
I could, because the atrial, I do it with for patients, okay. Genuinely.
Okay, you act it out and I'll translate your actions for the audience.
Well, the top vessels, which are your hands, are beating kind of irregularly, and the bottom, which are the ventricles, your legs, are beating at a normal rate, but the atria are kind of out of control and it's an irregular heartbeat. There's a clot risk associated with it.
Yep, a clot can grow in the atria and on the left side of your heart and flip off into your brain, causing a stroke. So not ideal. It's a potentially dangerous situation. And also, if you've got it, it can come back. And there are surgical ways of treating it. And we've covered a lot of this on the Health Report. But the question is, what makes it worse? And we recently covered a study, an Australian study, which showed that drinking alcohol can make atrial fibrillation worse or increase the recurrence rate. And the assumption was that caffeine might do the same thing, which is why, one of the reasons why they did a clinical trial. So here is Priya Alexander's classmate, Professor Christopher Wong.
Coffee has long been thought to be bad for your heart, and in particular, because it's a stimulant, it's always been thought that coffee makes the heart race and cause abnormal heartbeats.
So when you did this study, were you trying to prove that it was bad?
Well, to be honest, we weren't sure what the result was going to be. We've always thought that coffee stimulates abnormal heart rhythms, and that's certainly been the foundation for our advice that we give patients every day with heart rhythm disorders to reduce or abstain from coffee completely. But there are some studies that suggest that coffee may be beneficial in lowering the rate of abnormal heartbeats, but we haven't been certain that those results actually represent the truth.
Just describe how you did the study.
All studies beforehand on coffee and AF, this irregular heartbeat that we're talking of, which stands for atrial fibrillation, have been observational in nature. So they haven't what we call randomized patients to their group. So we did this randomized clinical trial where we flipped the coin, and that coin flip determined whether the participants either had to drink coffee for 6 months in duration or to abstain from all coffee, which included both caffeinated coffee and decaffeinated coffee, as well as all caffeinated products, which included chocolate, coffee, ice creams, and other products. So it was
Misery.
A really difficult trial. Yes.
Misery.
It took us many years to recruit the 200 participants because naturally many people didn't want to give up coffee and caffeine for 6 months.
And they had atrial fibrillation and they had another abnormal rhythm called atrial flutter. What's atrial flutter?
Atrial flutter is a related fast heartbeat. I kind of call it the cousin of atrial fibrillation. They're both fast heart rhythms from the top chambers of the heart, and many people have both.
So how do you know that they were obeying the rules and taking their cup of coffee a day?
We did rely on self-report, and as we expected, it wasn't perfect. 30% in the abstinence group actually consumed coffee at some point in time during the 6 months. We were surprised it wasn't higher than that, to be honest. But despite this non-compliance, we still saw our result favouring coffee, which actually suggests that if the abstinence group was completely compliant, maybe our results would be even more dramatic.
So what you were trying to prevent here was recurrence of atrial fibrillation. What were the actual results?
What we found, to our surprise, was that the group that consumed coffee actually had a 39% lower risk of developing recurrent atrial fibrillation, which was surprising and very important for clinical practice.
So what was going on here, do you think, with coffee? Because one of the things that you as heart rhythm specialists are concerned about with atrial fibrillation is a fast heartbeat. And one of the things that you do when you're treating atrial fibrillation is try and bring the heartbeat down to a lower level. So if you do get atrial fibrillation, the heart doesn't run away from itself. I'm putting it crudely now. You'd probably fail me in my final year in medicine from that description. But nonetheless, you kind of expect caffeine to speed up your heart rate to get a bit of a palpitation. So what was going on?
We looked at coffee, and so we can't disentangle which component of coffee is in fact beneficial.
So it might not be the caffeine?
It might not be the caffeine. You know, there's multiple other components in coffee, including various antioxidants and anti-inflammatory components. So it may be one of those components that's beneficial, but it similarly could be the caffeine as well. And that should be something that future studies should try to delve into. But you're quite right. Caffeine is a stimulant. It does make your heart race. But it's also quite a complex substance in that over time, there is a tolerance effect. The heart does speed up acutely when you start drinking coffee. But if you consume coffee over a long period of time, the overall effect is that you get used to it and your heart rate doesn't increase.
So it might have toughened up the heart in a way.
Something like that, yeah.
So if you go to the GP and you've got atrial fibrillation, I mean, is this something that should be recommended now? Is it ready for showtime?
I think we can now safely say to patients who have atrial fibrillation that they can safely consume coffee, at least at the amounts consumed in this trial, which was on average one cup per day. Importantly, we shouldn't extrapolate our results and say that 5-10 cups of coffee per day is safe.
So my 4 shots a day are not necessarily, you can't, you know.
It's possible it may be beneficial, but possibly may not be. And that, again, is something that could be studied in a future trial. But certainly about one cup a day is safe. The next step is to say, well, look, if you don't already have AF, is drinking coffee beneficial for your heart in terms of lowering your risk of AF? And that's something, again, which is speculative, but based on this trial, is something that maybe should be evaluated as well.
So in other words, coffee is not necessarily bad for your heart health.
No, it certainly seems like it may be beneficial, at least for heart rhythm disorders. And, you know, this is actually the first trial of coffee in any heart condition, full stop. There is observational data suggesting that coffee could potentially reduce your risk of heart attacks and heart failure and strokes. But again, that's only in what we call observational studies. And hopefully this trial encourages other researchers to trial coffee in the way that we have done on these conditions too.
So Australia's become a bit of a pioneer here in these sort of interventions in atrial fibrillation, because there was the Melbourne trial, which we covered not so long ago, which showed that alcohol drinking makes recurrence worse.
Absolutely. Alex Voskobojnik from Melbourne at the Baker ran a similar trial looking at alcohol and atrial fibrillation. But as you point out, alcohol has always been thought to be bad for atrial fibrillation, and his trial proved that it was. But it's interesting that clearly that there's obviously good dietary aspects and bad dietary aspects, and alcohol is bad for heart rhythm disorders, but coffee appears to be good.
Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me along today.
Chris Wong is Professor of Cardiology at the University of Adelaide and a cardiologist at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. So we're not endorsing my 5 shots a day here, but it might mean that if you've got atrial fibrillation, you might not need to avoid it. But we're not talking here, we'll probably just need to put a caveat in here, is there are other quite potentially dangerous, more dangerous and more acutely dangerous arrhythmias of the lower chambers of the heart, the ventricles. And we're not making any comment about ventricular arrhythmias. Those are serious. You often need an implantable device, and that's got to be discussed with an expert in heart rhythms. But we are talking about the much more common atrial fibrillation.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about a relatively new tech. Well, it's not that new, but it's a technology called liquid biopsies. And it's the idea that you can pick up stuff in the blood, DNA, which might be able to either diagnose cancer in the first place or monitor cancer once you're being treated. But is it ready, as they say, for showtime? Stay tuned.
Earlier this year, we spoke about some treatment updates for asthma for adolescents and adults, where the advice came out from the National Asthma Council to ditch the blue puffer ideally, and to replace it with a combination inhaler that had both steroid in it and a quick but long-acting version of the reliever. So it's a combination inhaler, no more blue puffer. Do you remember that, Norman? We're checking your memory.
I do. I remember it as if it was 3 weeks ago.
Excellent. What we didn't talk about then was children. And children were not included in that update, but there has just been the first ever randomised controlled trial that's looked at this combination inhaler, so steroid with the reliever in it as well, as the sole therapy for children aged 5 to 15. So no use of the blue puffer.
Now, once upon a time, I was going to become a respiratory physician before I joined the ABC in paediatrics. And for many years, there was such a dearth of research in children and asthma that you were actually using adult drugs in children, what's called off-label, because they hadn't been, the trials the had not been done. And there was a lot of research. A lot of it came out actually from Western Australia with Professor Lou Landau and Peter LeSwift, and also out of the University of Melbourne Royal Children's Hospital, which suggested that asthma in children was not the same disease as asthma in adults.
That's right. And that's what Paul Robinson, the person I spoke to, said as well.
But now we have some clarity.
We do. We have research happening in this space. It's also very helpful, I think, for parents and caregivers who are sometimes a bit cautious or worried about the side effects of steroids in kids. So the question is combination therapy the way to go in kids? What are the potential harms? Are there any? I spoke with Paul Robinson, who's the Professor of Respiratory and Sleep Medicine at Queensland Children's Hospital.
What we know from current Australian data is that there's almost 500,000 children that are affected by asthma. And what we know about poorly controlled asthma is that it affects about half of our asthmatics. So what that means is half of the children with asthma continue to have an unacceptable level of symptoms and continue to have asthma attacks. And the approach to asthma has changed in the last decade because there's been a realization that it's important for us to not accept asthma attacks as part and parcel of asthma, but to aim for all of our children and adults with asthma to be free from asthma attacks. And by helping them be free from asthma attacks, we're helping reduce their risk of bad outcomes from asthma and also lifelong outcomes from asthma. So this study is looking at a strategy to manage asthma to try and improve asthma control and reduce asthma attacks in children 5 to 15 years of age. And it's taking an approach that has become more commonly used in the adolescent and adult populations around the world, where we can give a single medication or a single inhaler that contains both a reliever and a preventer.
So that's the combination inhaler that we saw discussed in the asthma guideline update this year for adults and adolescents, where the advice was to really ditch the blue puffer, that salbutamol, that quick reliever, in favour of this combination inhaler. Is that correct?
Yes.
So is that the way that we're headed for children as well, aged 5 to 15, do you think, to move towards this combination therapy?
I think we're moving towards it. What we need is evidence to support it being the most effective approach. And what we know about asthma is it is not a condition where we can simply extrapolate evidence from older age groups. So what I mean by that is if something works in adults, say that it will work in kids. We actually need childhood-specific evidence. And this is what that study looks to try and provide.
So what are some of the key findings to come out of this, of the CARE trial?
So what they did in the CARE study is they took children with mild asthma and they were included in this study if they'd required their Ventolin on three or more consecutive days in the last 12 months, or on average were taking it two or more days per month over the past 12 months, or they'd required an urgent asthma medical review in the past 12 months. In essence, these are children with mild asthma with evidence of having asthma attacks or asthma symptoms in the past year, and they randomized them. So in half of the children, they simply took their Ventolin as they would normally do for symptoms, and in the other half, they gave them the combination inhaler or the air therapy, which in this case was Symbicort, budesonide, formoterol. The main aspect they were interested in was asthma attacks over the course of the year. And I think what was really encouraging in this study is they were able to see that actually in those managed with the combination inhaler or the air therapy, they were able to reduce the number of asthma attacks by 45%.
Which is quite significant. So the combination therapy was really quite effective at preventing asthma attacks, but it's also probably even more key that there were no adverse effects, because I think a lot of people get quite nervous about steroids in children. But there didn't appear to be any impact on things like growth.
Yes, which is important. So there's, whilst we're very interested in the beneficial effects, we're interested in making sure we minimise risks or side effects of medication, and we saw no effects on growth.
This trial was undertaken during the pandemic, so there were public health measures in place and potentially less circulating bugs and viruses. Do we think that might have impacted the results in any way?
It did probably have an effect. One of the things they were unable to show in this study was that a number of severe attacks And those are attacks which precipitate or cause the need for oral corticosteroids to be given, which is a stronger form of steroid to try and open up the airways and counteract inflammation. They weren't able to show a significant difference in those type of attacks. And that may reflect the fact that there were just less attacks happening and those that happened weren't as severe as usual. And I also think that when they looked in particular age ranges, so this was a study that was interested in 5 to 15-year-olds, they did a subgroup analysis where they look at individual age groups. So for instance, they look at 12 to 15 and they looked at 5 to 11-year-olds. Is they saw this beneficial effect in those aged 12 to 15, but the results didn't quite reach significance for those between 5 to 11 years of age. And again, it may reflect different aspects, one of which could be that there were just less asthma attacks happening.
So the greatest efficacy was seen in that 12 to 15 age group, was it? And the same thing wasn't seen in the younger children?
That's correct. And there may be other factors that come into play that we need to try and understand. For instance, in younger age groups, such as 5 to 11-year-olds, there's a greater dependence on the child communicating how they feel to the parent, which may be not as prominent, you know, or as much of an issue in the slightly older kids who may have that ability to sense the symptoms and respond by giving medication.
Okay, so they can self-administer. At the moment, Paul, if you go to somewhere like the National Asthma Council in Australia, this combination therapy that we're talking about, which could potentially reshape asthma care for children down the track, but it's not currently recommended for children under 12 years of age. How long does it take for the results of something like this trial to actually impact clinical care on the ground? And what else do we need to know before that actually happens, before guidelines update?
I think this is an important step forward. I think it's important to realise that the process by which the recommendations appeared in the Australian Asthma Handbook for 12 years and above is a process where there's been a number of studies done in that age group, that it's been something adopted on international guidelines and then has now filtered through to Australian guidelines. And I expect the process for the younger kids will be one where we will look for further evidence. There'll be further discussions about understanding exactly who is likely to benefit from this approach, but also understanding what the barriers are likely to be to implementation and what the challenges might be.
So for adults, you know, the big update really for 2025 was ideally ditch that blue puffer and use some form of combination therapy if you need it. For children at the moment, for parents who are listening, thinking, you know, are things going to evolve in this space? It's really check in with your health professional and ensure that your child's asthma treatment is optimised. But at the moment, the advice of ditching the blue puffer doesn't hold for children.
I think for the younger age group, the most important thing is we need to have a really strong focus on good asthma control. And so it means that basically we need to be aware of the children with asthma that continue to have symptoms, that are continue to use their blue puffer more than twice a week, or have a history of exacerbations in the last 12 months, that they should see their health professional and be asking about the role of a preventer and inhaled corticosteroid preventer.
Professor Paul Robinson at Queensland Children's Hospital.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. So this next interview is a little bit indulgent on my part, is that I've been opening the journals, Priya, as I do on a regular basis. And a lot of the journals now, you start to see these trends in journals. The things become trendy and they're a bit hyped up. And every time you open a journal, there's a new thing, on a new bit of information. And one of the things that's really getting hyped up has been a technology called liquid biopsies. So this is where DNA in your blood, which has spun off a tumour, they can pick it up. It's called circulating tumour DNA. And they pick it up, they test it, and there are two main ways of using this technology. One is early detection of cancer, and that's what a lot of hype has been in the journals. But you can feel the commerce behind it. Mm-hmm. We've got a bank of 10 different circulating tumour DNA tests. We can use this as a substitute for screening or to supplement screening, and you can find out about all these tumours. It's the same sort of language that they use in whole body MRI scanning, and you start to get sceptical reading this. But, you know, it might be a bit unfair that I'm being sceptical. But another way of using this is actually when you've got cancer, to modify the treatment, particularly detecting the cancer if it comes back early and finding out if you're on the right kind of treatment. So I just wanted to get an idea of where we are at with that without my hyped up skepticism. And one of the Australian experts in liquid biopsies and the associated technology who's actually doing clinical trials in this area is Professor Sarah Jane Dawson, who's a clinician scientist at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre and the Centre for Cancer Research at the University of Melbourne.
For the test to be used for early cancer detection, it needs to do several things very effectively. It needs to be very specific. So it needs to be able to correctly identify negative cases, and it needs to be very sensitive. So we want to be able to correctly identify individuals who do have an underlying cancer. And then even if these tests do detect these cancer signals in the blood, they also need to identify where in the body the cancer may be, because if we're going to be able to identify and treat that cancer effectively, we need to try and understand what type of cancer this individual has developed. So there's a range of different features in trying to understand how accurate these tests might be.
In other words, you might get several cancers that throw off the same DNA and you've got no idea what cancer you're picking up, whereas you want to find a test that's specific to the pancreas or the lung or the colon, for example.
That's exactly right. And the tests are absolutely improving. They're getting better at doing this all of the time. However, we need to understand whether the implementation of these types of tests is going to lead to survival benefits for patients in the long run. These tests are expensive and complex. We need to understand whether they can lead to improvements in survival for patients if we're using these tests.
Okay, so thank you for that. When I read a paper, which I'm increasingly doing, particularly from the United States, saying this is ready for showtime, when we've got a panel of 10 tests, let's go, folks. Just slow down. We've just got to wait here in terms of the screening side.
There's a number of studies at the moment which are using simulated data to try and understand what the benefits of these tests might be. And they look very encouraging. They suggest that these tests could help diagnose cancers at an earlier stage. And if we do that, the implication is we may be able to improve survival. But we still don't have real-world data to support that at the current time, but it's going to be several years until we have that. They wouldn't replace the current screening that is happening at the moment, but we only have screening tests available for four cancer types at the moment: breast cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal cancer, and lung cancer. So there are a large number of cancers that don't have appropriate screening tests. So the goal is that these tests would supplement rather than replace current screening strategies and could be quite helpful to diagnose those cancer types where we actually don't have effective screening, and several of these cancers can be detected at late stages.
Let's just talk about monitoring once you've actually been treated for cancer, because one of the problems in cancer research is that it's focused on the initial cancer and knocking that on the head. And there's far less research done on cancer spread and what happens when cancer has spread, which is much more difficult to treat. One of the problems here with secondary spread is that you might be using a drug which you thought would work, but doesn't because of the genetics of the cancer or the genetics of the person. And the liquid biopsy might actually help you to say, oh, wrong drug, let's move to another one because of the testing of this one. That's a crude way of describing how some of these liquid biopsies work. But how close are we to that, which says, okay, we're starting you on treatment, but we're going to do these blood tests to see whether we can refine the treatment to make it more effective?
We're very close to that application. So in patients that are undergoing treatment for cancer, these tests can be helpful in monitoring the effectiveness of that therapy so that we can avoid continuing ineffective treatments in patients and exposing them to the risk of unnecessary side effects. Once an individual is diagnosed with cancer, these tests can be extremely helpful in understanding whether that individual is responding to treatment or not.
It took a while for Australia to really get into genomics and cancer. You had places like Melbourne, to some extent Brisbane, where it was almost standard of care to really test the genes in a cancer. Now it's pretty widespread, but it took a long time for oncologists throughout Australia to catch up with that. To what extent is this becoming the standard of care? And regardless of where you are in Australia, you should be able to expect liquid biopsies to monitor your progress and refine treatment.
The technology is right for clinical application, but we don't have Medicare reimbursement of liquid biopsy tests for patients in Australia at the current time. So outside of research studies and clinical trials, these tests are still very difficult to access. The clinical trials are important because we need them to show that the implementation of these tests will lead to survival benefits for patients. But the technology is ready now. So this evidence will come, and I think that that will make a compelling case for reimbursement of these tests so that they can be widely available to all patients Australia-wide.
Why are they so expensive?
The technology is improving and the costs are coming down, but they do rely on complex genomic sequencing. But the argument would be if they can tell us important information about therapeutic choices and whether treatments are being effective or ineffective, then these tests could save the health system money if we can improve the efficiency of cancer treatment in the long term.
So give me a flavour of some of the trials you're involved with.
Yes, so we're involved in trials looking at several different applications of this technology. We're also involved in trials where we're using these tests to follow patients after they have been treated for cancer. So these tests can be very powerful in identifying patients that may be at risk of their cancer returning. And if we can identify those patients, then we can intervene, hopefully, with therapies that may be able to eradicate any residual disease that that individual may have.
So in other words, you might be able to detect a molecular relapse rather than a lump relapse, to be crude about it.
That's exactly right.
Which, of course, opens up a whole area of discussion, which we've covered on the Health Report before, which is, does cancer surveillance save lives? And there's a big debate in the cancer community about whether it does, or whether it just you just discover that you have relapsed earlier than you would otherwise know, but it didn't make any difference to your overall survival.
And I think we're right to come back to wanting to show that these tests actually improve survival outcomes for individuals diagnosed with cancer. We are using them in a research setting quite frequently now for patients who have cancer, and they're very effective. But it's a different scenario if you're approaching this, you know, across the whole population for early cancer detection.
Professor Sarah Jane Dawson, who's a clinical oncologist at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre and the Centre for Cancer Research at the University of Melbourne.
So we're talking about a run-of-the-mill blood test, though.
Yeah, they take blood and they analyse it looking for these shreds of DNA.
Okay.
And you've got to be sure. So it's much easier if they know what cancer you've got and they're monitoring it because they're looking for the DNA from that specific cancer. But if you're otherwise healthy, and they take the blood test and they find DNA.
What are you looking for?
They don't know, it's a needle in a haystack, or they can find it, but they don't know what it means. But according to Sarah Jane, it's really close to being able to be used as a regular thing in the cancer clinic for treating cancer. It's just that it's not subsidised and they're not cheap tests. So there is a use for them, but whether or not they are utilised in screening will be down the track.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
What have we got in the mailbag?
Ellie has written in relation to our extensive discussions and repeated discussions on food allergies and the introduction of solids and allergy starter packs. But Ellie writes, 2 days after our staff first aid training, a colleague of mine here in Port Macquarie had to administer an EpiPen to himself on the weekend because he ate a pre-made pasta sauce that contained sheep's milk. Another colleague's wife felt her throat closing over after having limoncello that unexpectedly contained goat's milk, which is unusual. A third friend from Darwin carries an EpiPen everywhere after developing a sudden and extreme allergy to goat's milk. Ellie writes, all three of these people were using goat's milk soap on skin conditions like eczema or dermatitis at the time. Oh, my goodness. And this brings us to a passion of mine.
Well, is the passion how you induce allergies by small doses? if you want to induce an allergy to goat's milk, a really good way of doing it is putting small goat's milk.
It's to not put any food proteins on your skin, but particularly infants. All food proteins should be avoided in infant skincare, particularly for babies. There's so many fancy things, Norman. Like, I have been in this space recently as a parent. You could buy the fanciest stuff for your child and you turn over the label and it's got goat's milk or almond oil or something in there. You shouldn't be rubbing things that you should eat on your skin because the immune system sees it and is more likely to react to it. It should be seeing food through the gut. Eat the food, don't put it on your skin.
But of course, I mean, you're banging on about children here. I'm not being silly, actually. Just teasing you.
I do bang on.
But these are adults. I mean, what could be going on? I mean, I suppose they could be developing allergy later in life, or they haven't had exposure to goat's milk at all in life. I mean, there's a couple of things going on there, I see. But,
well, it's tricky. Normally we do say, because parents will often say to me, Priya, so when can I start rubbing almond milk on my child? But truly, people go, okay, I'll avoid it. You keep banging on about it, Priya, in the consult and on social media. So they do avoid it. When can I do it? And I say, ideally, once the food is reliably in your child's diet, if they haven't reacted. Whether or not the adults in Ellie's email have never had goat's milk and been rubbing it and therefore the body's been sensitised because it's never seen it before, or...
You can get the late development of an allergy during life.
Yep. I just don't rub food things on my body. I go with really boring, bland stuff if I put anything on there at all. And if you don't love goat's milk cheese like me, you may actually never have had consumed goat's milk before. And if you've been putting on in your skin, that's how your body's met it in adulthood.
And what a disappointment in life if you spoil your enjoyment of goat's milk because you've been putting crap on your skin.
I agree. Just go, the blander the better is what I think.
And don't forget to write to us at...
healthreport@abc.net.au and tell us what you're rubbing on your skin because we do want to know.
Yeah, I'm not... you sure about that, Priya? Okay. Yeah, do write in and tell us.
I'm the GP, so I'm happy to hear it.
Okay, fine. We'll sanitise it before it gets to air. And don't forget our sister podcast, Watch That Rash. Today we're talking about acid-base balance. What's acid-base balance? It's basically the balance between acid and alkaline in your body. Should you be eating an alkaline diet? The answer is really interesting and not necessarily what you think I'm going to be saying.
Oh, he's getting us all in. I'll take the bait. I'm in. I'll see you next week.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.